Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 350, recorded Friday, June 8th, 2018. John Carreyrou, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the people, some of the most interesting people in tech, or the people writing about the most interesting people in tech. And I am very excited about our guest today. In 2003, a young Stanford dropout decided she was going to create an arm patch that had needles in it that would test for various ailments. And for the next decade or so, she was definitely someone I would have loved to interview on this show. And I would still love to interview her now, mostly to ask, what were you thinking? Because in 2015, a writer for the Wall Street Journal began to uncover the reality behind the company that she'd started. And the writer, of course, is John Carreyrou, and he is here to talk today about his book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
So I loved reading this book. As I was saying to you before we started, I loved everything about it except for the fact that it's true. I wish it were fiction, but it is not. I'm still in a little bit of disbelief that all of this could have happened just so recently. Talk a little bit first about who Elizabeth Holmes was and why she created Theranos.
So she created Theranos in late 2003 after dropping out of Stanford as a 19-year-old sophomore. She really wanted to be an entrepreneur. Steve Jobs was her idol. She loved Apple. And she had a vision for a product that was actually a medical product. The first vision she had was for a wristband that would have these microneedles that would draw minute amounts of your blood and diagnose from the blood whatever ailed you and simultaneously inject the appropriate drug. It was more science fiction than reality. And I think she and her co-founder at the time realized that pretty quickly. And, after a few months pivoted to something they thought was more feasible, which was a device inspired from the portable glucose monitors that have been around for more than a decade, that diabetes patients use to monitor their blood sugar levels. Except, Elizabeth wanted a portable device that would do, way more than just one test. She wanted a device that would do the full range of lab tests just off a tiny drop of blood pricked from a finger. And that became the, vision that Theranos, went about pursuing, and trying to execute over the next decade.
Now, if you're watching the video version, you saw first the article by Ken Auletta from The New Yorker and then John's article, which are two of the big, I mean, a big player in this story is the press, specifically the tech press. And John, you're a medical writer. You're not a tech writer, right? Or you weren't a tech writer before you started writing about this.
I've done different things in my nearly 20-year career at The Wall Street Journal. I've been a foreign correspondent. I've worked in Europe. I've reported on business in Europe. I've reported on Islamic terrorism. In the past 10 years, I've mostly written about medicine. And I'm an investigative reporter, and I can pretty much choose my topic because I'm an opportunist and I tend to go after tips. But I certainly have done a ton of reporting on medicine and the U.S. healthcare system. And the way I came onto this story was actually, because of a tip I got from someone who had become a source during past reporting on the U.S. healthcare system.
So that New Yorker article came shortly before you got the tip, right? I mean, I in the book you talk about how you had read that article and sort of it sounded like it wasn't exact. There was something a little off about Ken Auletta, who's also not really a tech writer, but more of a media It's a little bit of a tech writer, but not a medical writer for sure.
Yeah, he's written about, I think he's written a book on Google. He's written a ton, certainly, about the media. He has definitely not written much, if anything at all, about medicine. And that was the pattern among the reporters who wrote about her and put her on the map. And I must disclose that the first publication to put her on the map and to give her airtime in September 2013 was my own newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. It was our editorial page that did a friendly interview with her, coinciding with when she launched Theranos fingerstick tests in Walgreens stores. But yeah, the first thing that gave me, you know, a hunch that something was not right at Theranos was the Ken Auletta story in The New Yorker that I read on the way back from work one evening on the subway. And I guess the thing that struck me the most about that story was this notion that a 19-year-old college dropout who'd had, you know, essentially two semesters of chemical engineering classes under her belt could just drop out and then go on to pioneer groundbreaking new medical science. I knew that had happened before with computers and software. You know, Mark Zuckerberg, legend has it, learned to code on his father's computer when he was 10 years old and then went on to create Facebook, and Bill Gates, 30 years before him, learned to, you know, pretty much taught himself how to program as well, and of course built Microsoft. And so these are stories that real stories that had happened before in Silicon Valley, but medicine is different. You know, I knew from all my reporting that you need real training in medicine. You need to have gone to medical school. Often people get PhDs and do postdoctoral studies and do years and decades of research before they add value. So the thought that she had just dropped out and snapped her finger and invented, you know, groundbreaking new blood testing technology struck me as odd. To be fair, I probably would not have done anything with that hunch if I hadn't then gotten a tip a few weeks later. The tipster was someone I had encountered the previous year reporting a story on Medicare fraud and abuse. He was a practicing clinical pathologist in the Midwest who moonlighted as the writer of this blog, obscure blog called Pathology Blog, which he spelled B-L-A-W-G. I don't think he had very many readers, but he had caught my attention the previous year when I was reporting on Medicare fraud, and I had reached out to him, and he had been kind enough to explain to me the complexities of laboratory billing, and that's how we met. And then when he read the New Yorker story, he had immediate doubts about the claims that Theranos was making in it, and he wrote a skeptical blog item on his blog, and was immediately contacted by this little band of Theranos skeptics, one of whom was a childhood neighbor of Elizabeth Holmes named Richard Fuse, who had gone on to be involved in patent litigation with Elizabeth Holmes. And during that patent litigation had become convinced that Theranos, you know, was built on a scaffolding of lies. And it also so happened that Richard Fuse had just made contact with a former employee of Theranos who had just left the company, and he was the laboratory director. And so when the pathology blogger contacted me, it was clear to me that he didn't have firsthand information and that Richard Fuse himself didn't have firsthand information, but the notion that there was someone out there who was a primary source who had just left the company and who did have firsthand information and was alleging wrongdoing, you know, immediately caught my interest. And at that point, I knew that I needed to get in touch with this ex-laboratory director. And so I worked on getting in touch with him, and I did eventually. And he was terrified. He was being hounded by Theranos lawyers. He would only speak to me on deep background if I granted him confidentiality, which I did. And that was the beginning of my reporting.
So you mentioned her obsession, Elizabeth Holmes' obsession with Steve Jobs, which was weird a little bit. I mean, it was a little bit later in, in Theranos's trajectory, she started wearing black turtlenecks like Steve Jobs. She named one of the devices, the 4S, after the iPhone, the latest iPhone at that time. And also had like a very deep voice that some people reported was affected, wasn't exactly her real voice. But what's really struck me as the difference between her and people like Mark Zuckerberg, who she actually came up with. That was something that I needed to be reminded of. She wasn't post Mark Zuckerberg. She was at the same time as Mark Zuckerberg. So, but so much of how Theranos was built was her childhood connections. You mentioned her childhood neighbor who was partly her downfall, but then she had another neighbor. She grew up with Tim Draper's daughter, right?
Right. Her parents and she and her brother had lived in Woodside, California for several years in the late 80s, early 90s. And their neighbors had been the Drapers, and Tim Draper was of course, coming up as one of the most successful startup investors in the Valley. And he has a daughter named Jessie Draper, and Jessie and Elizabeth became good friends. And their friendship endured. And when Elizabeth dropped out of Stanford in 2003, she knocked on Tim Draper's door and pitched him, and he cut her first check for $1 million. So that was an important family connection or childhood connection. Another one was Don Lucas, the famous venture capitalist who groomed Larry Ellison, helped him take Oracle public in the late 80s. He was introduced to Elizabeth by a friend of her father's. Her father had gone to Wesleyan and had remained good friends with a guy who was a high-ranking official at the World Bank. And that person knew Don Lucas, and so he had made an introduction to Elizabeth, and Don Lucas was impressed to hear that Elizabeth was the descendant of the Fleischmann Yeast dynasty, and that's the very successful company that was founded in the late 1800s by two Hungarian immigrants who had come to the U.S. and by the turn of the 20th century, the Fleischmanns and the Holmeses became one of the richest families in America. Later generations of the family squandered the fortune. And so Elizabeth grew up with tales of the incredible success of those early generations, but also with tales of the failures of the younger generations, such as her father's grandfather and father, who had both lived sort of decadent lives and squandered away the family wealth. And I think that family context is important when you try to understand the psychology of Elizabeth Holmes. I think she was raised to be very aware of this lineage, and she wanted to restore, you know, that family glory and wealth in part. She was also influenced by the fact that her father was a civil servant for a public service for most of his career, worked at the State Department, at USAID. There were photos of him in war-torn countries providing disaster relief around the house. And he always told her growing up that she needed to live a purposeful life. And so she was ambitious. She wanted to become rich, but she also wanted to do good. And the way to achieve both was biotechnology and this vision she had for a medical device that would make blood testing better and easier and that would eventually, you know, help mankind.
So by all accounts, she didn't start out trying to lie to everyone. She, you know, wanted to save the world, as did Mark Zuckerberg and many other people who end up in Silicon Valley. But the difference between them is that, you know, this was biomedical technology. This was or just medical technology. It wasn't, we could argue that Facebook is now a dangerous tool that Mark Zuckerberg never imagined that it was as well, but it's not exactly the same thing. Why do you think she didn't try to be like Genentech or some of those other, I mean, you know, the Bay Area has other, is not all Silicon Valley. It's not tech. There is a lot of biomedical. Why did she position herself in Silicon Valley amongst these other pure tech companies instead of the medical companies that are also out here?
Well, she wanted to be an icon like Steve Jobs had become an icon. She wanted to become rich, and she wanted to become famous, and she wanted to join this pantheon of tech legends. You know, I don't think many people know who the founder of Genentech is, mm-hmm. or who the founders of those other biotech firms and medical technology firms are, but they certainly know who Steve Jobs is, and they know who Bill Gates is. And so she began to model herself after him in ways that were sometimes cartoonish. I mean, she started wearing a black turtleneck in the 2006, 2007 period, because that was the Jobs attire. She called her early iterations of the Theranos device the iPod of healthcare. She hired Shai Day, the Los Angeles-based advertising agency, because Apple had used it for some of its iconic campaigns. She even tried to get Lee Clow, who was the creative genius behind several iconic Apple campaigns, to come out of retirement. He referred her to the agency, and so she ended up working with a guy named Patrick O'Neill, who was the Lee Clow's successor. She scheduled meetings with Shai Tae on Wednesdays because she learned that that's the day that Steve Jobs had his meetings with Shai Tae. And so, you know, the obsession with Jobs was really, I mean, it was there. And I talked to numerous employees who attested to the fact that was like a really guiding obsession for her. And unfortunately, I think that it was a giant mistake on her part, because, Apple, even still to this day, is really a computer company. It's computer hardware and it's software. Now the computer is a small phone, but it's still a computer company. And Theranos's device was a medical device. It wasn't software. It was a blood testing machine that was going to be used by patients and doctors to make crucial health decisions. And so she modeled herself after the wrong industry. And she should have, in fact, looked to South San Francisco and the biotech cluster and diagnostic companies in the area. But instead, she chose the computer industry.
So let's talk a little bit about the technology, the device itself. Like, what did it look like, and how did it evolve over the years?
So the first vision was of a wristband, as I said, which she called a TheraPatch. And I got a hold of an early presentation she made to investors. This is back in 2005, and there's a diagram of what the TheraPatch looks like. But I don't think the TheraPatch was ever even built as a prototype. The company quickly pivoted to, as I said, a device that was inspired by the glucose monitors. And it was basically a toaster-sized reader and a cartridge. And the cartridge involved microfluidics. And you put the blood in the cartridge, and then you slotted the cartridge in the toaster-sized reader. And pumps and valves in the reader made the blood flow through the cartridge. And it then came into contact with reagents and antibodies, and it produced a chemical reaction that then produced a signal, and the result would be beamed wirelessly to a server, and the result would be analyzed. And actually, that microfluidic system, which was dubbed the Theranos 1.0, they worked on it for several years, and they could never get it to work. It was totally hit and miss. I mean, they essentially got nowhere with it. And in late 2007, she was probably under pressure because of the promises she had made to investors. So they pivoted away from the microfluidic system. And a Theranos engineer ordered a glue dispensing robot from a company called Fisnar in New Jersey, and used that as the basis for the new Theranos device, the second generation Theranos device, and affixed a pipette at the end of this robotic arm that had 3 degrees of motion, forward and back, left and right, and up and down, and programmed this robotic arm on a gantry to mimic the steps that a laboratory scientist would do at the bench testing blood. And it was kind of a rudimentary machine. She had Yves Béal, the pretty well-known Swiss industrial designer, design a sleek black and white case for it that hid those rudimentary innards. And she christened it the Edison, after Thomas Edison. And that was the second generation of the technology. It was a machine that could only do one class of blood tests known as immunoassays, which are tests that use antibodies to create chemical reactions to measure the concentrations of analytes in the blood. By late 2010, Theranos started working on the third and last iteration of the technology because Elizabeth wasn't satisfied with the Edison because it could only do one class of blood test. And she'd already promised not only investors, but two retail partners, Walgreens and Safeway, that she already had a technology that could do all the tests off just a drop of blood. And so at that point, they started in late 2010, started working on what she called the mini lab. And the mini lab was a bigger machine than the Edison because you needed to pack more instruments into it. And by the time 3 years later, Theranos went live with these finger stick tests in Walgreens stores in Northern California and Arizona, the mini lab was actually still a work in progress. It was just a prototype and it didn't work at all. It was years from being a commercially ready device. And so Elizabeth and her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, who was the number two of the company at that point, decided to go live with the Edison. They dusted off the Edison and launched with that for a handful of tests, a handful of immunoassays. And then for the 240 or so other tests on the 250 test menu that they advertised on the Theranos website, they used regular machines made by the likes of Siemens, the German conglomerate, machines that any lab could purchase. With one wrinkle, which is that they hacked the one Siemens machine in particular, the Siemens Advia 1800, to try to adapt it to tiny blood samples. And one of the modifications they made is they diluted the blood to create more volume because the Siemens machine was equipped to handle normal size blood draws drawn from the arm. And so they needed to create more volume. And the way they did that was by diluting the blood with a saline solution. And that caused all sorts of problems because the Siemens machines already had a dilution step as part of its protocol. And so this was effectively pre-diluting the blood, diluting it twice. And the more you adulterate blood sample, the more room you create for error, not to mention the fact that this dilution protocol diluted the analytes, the made the concentration of the substances you were trying to measure in the blood so low that it fell beneath the analytic measurement range that the FDA had approved for the machine. So it meant using the Siemens machine in a way that both Siemens and its regulator, the FDA, disapproved of. And that led to a lot of unreliable test results.
It's amazing. I mean, one of the things that everyone knows about Steve Jobs is he was such a perfectionist and he wanted things exactly his way and he made demands on people. And, you know, the inside of the computer has to look as good as the outside. And we've heard it all. And maybe the worst thing that's happened as a result of that is people had to work late and didn't see their families. And but this was part of what Elizabeth asked. Like, she didn't like needles. She never wanted to draw too much blood. Right. So the samples were so small and needed to be diluted because of her demands.
Right. But medical science is hard, and sometimes it doesn't just take a bunch of late nights, you know, and a year of late nights to crack that nut. In fact, to this day, no one has cracked that nut. And by that nut, I mean figuring out how to run many blood tests on a tiny sample of blood pricked from the finger. And there are different reasons for that. One of them is that there are about a half dozen big classes of blood tests, and that each class of blood tests requires completely different methods and techniques and instruments. And so once you've done a couple of immunoassay on your tiny finger stick sample, you don't have any blood left to run the completely different set of techniques that a general chemistry test or a hematology test require. And that problem just has not been solved. The other problem is with capillary samples, which means blood that comes from the finger as opposed to a vein in the arm. When you milk blood from a finger, often you put stress on the red blood cells and they explode. And when they explode, they release potassium. And as a result, the concentration of potassium in the blood increases. And this is, in fact, one of the problems that Theranos ran into. And my source, the ex-lab director, told me that they were routinely getting potassium results for patients that were so high that the only way in which they made sense were if the patients were dead. except the patients were alive, so that the blood tests were clearly wrong and didn't make any sense. It's hard. Medical science is hard. Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani and Theranos ran into these obstacles and refused to acknowledge these setbacks and papered over them, essentially.
So we're talking about like lots of errors in tests, which can be upsetting to be told that you have cancer when you don't, or to be told that you don't have cancer when you do. I mean, do we think that, is there any proof that anyone died from these errors in these test results?
I don't know. It's hard to prove a direct correlation between a health outcome and a blood test. You can have, basically there are two scenarios. One is a misdiagnosis, and in some ways that's the worst, because if a person has a serious ailment such as cancer and the blood test misses the cancer, then the patient doesn't get treated and may eventually die. And then there's the false positive, which is a blood test that tells you that you have a condition and you get treated unnecessarily for it, and that can lead to all sorts of problems as well. What I did come across in my reporting is more than a dozen examples of patients who had health scares because they got false positives. And in particular, a woman in Arizona who had her test done at Theranos and six, I think, of her results came back abnormally elevated. And she had a symptom, which was a ringing in her ear. And based on the symptom and the blood test results, her doctor began to fear that she was on the cusp of a stroke and sent her to the emergency room on the eve of Thanksgiving in 2014. And she spent 4 hours in the ER at the hospital getting a battery of tests. And after a while, they retested her blood again at the hospital, and those blood tests came back normal. She then had more MRIs the following week to make sure that it really was that the Theranos results really were false. And by the way, I had a high deductible insurance plan, so ended up spending $3,000 on these medical services out of her own pocket. And finally, she and her doctor were able to conclude that the Theranos blood tests were not accurate. So this is the sort of thing that people got put through completely unnecessarily. And in terms of, you know, whether people were actually harmed or not, there's a patient in Arizona, one of a dozen who have sued, alleging consumer fraud and medical battery. He alleges that a Theranos blood test failed to detect his heart disease and that he then had a stroke that could have been prevented. Those allegations will have to be proven in court. What we do know is that Theranos has voided or corrected nearly a million blood test results in California and Arizona, most of them in Arizona. And a source recently told me that the last lab director Theranos had, who recently left the company as part of layoffs, was pushing Elizabeth Holmes to void or correct every single blood test the company had ever returned to a patient, because he felt the quality control had been so abysmal that Theranos couldn't possibly stand by really any of the test results that it had given patients. So now you'd be talking about almost 8 million blood tests voided or corrected.
Well, we should take a step back and talk a little bit about why, how they got into the hands of patients. So first, Theranos tried to go to partner with pharmaceutical companies, but that didn't really work out. So then they moved to Safeway and Walgreens. And I mean, there was so much interesting things going on with these two companies fighting with each other. Talk a little bit about what role those two companies had in pushing these devices more quickly than they should have been.
Right. I'd say Walgreens was a key to a lot of this and how, this fraud was perpetrated and how it lasted so long. Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani approached Walgreens in early 2010 and asserted to the company that they had this technology. It could do a bunch of blood tests off just a drop of blood pricked from a finger. And Walgreens hired actually a lab consultant named Kevin Hunter, to help it kick the tires and verify that Theranos' claims were true. And this guy, Kevin Hunter, traveled with Walgreens executives several times to Palo Alto to meet with Elizabeth and Sonny. And he started asking questions. He wanted to see the lab. He asked for a comparison study. And soon Elizabeth and Sonny were displeased with him and his nettlesome questions. And they asked Walgreens to no longer include him in in-person meetings between the two companies and in these weekly video conference calls that they had. And they made clear that they would walk away if Walgreens, didn't do what they said. And so amazingly, Walgreens at that point excluded its own lab consultant that it was paying, to protect its own interest from meetings going forward. And he was marginalized. He tried to argue with his superior at Walgreens to not do this, but Walgreens did. And the reason Walgreens did, Walgreens was obsessed with its rivalry with CVS, its larger rival, which is based in Rhode Island. Walgreens is based in the suburb of Chicago. And executives at Walgreens saw everything through the prism of this rivalry. And they were terrified that Theranos would walk away and turn to CVS and strike a deal with CVS, and that then that partnership would be a great success, and that Walgreens would be regretting it for the next 10 or 20 years. So the fear of missing out, FOMO as it's known, played a big role in the way Walgreens accepted Theranos' claims at face value.
It feels like FOMO was, it feels like Safeway and Walgreens and the tech press and the investors were all experiencing that. Like, they didn't want to be the ones that, were writing about Steve Jobs 20 years later. Like, they wanted to be the people discovering them, right? I mean, discovering her.
Absolutely. Roger Parloff, the correspondent at Fortune, wrote the cover story about Elizabeth Holmes in the June 2014 issue. And his attention was initially attracted by something else, by this patent suit between the childhood neighbor and Elizabeth Holmes. And, the thing that he found interesting was that David Boies himself had litigated it on behalf of this company that at that point he'd never heard of. And he called up David Boies' PR handler, and that was initially his angle. Why is David Boies doing this case? And there's also, the brother of one of the defendants, who's also the son of the other, is saying that he did nothing wrong and that these patent theft allegations are completely true. He's threatening to sue Theranos and Boies. And that's what got him interesting. And the PR handler was successful in reorienting his attention to Elizabeth and her achievement, her supposed achievements, and to Theranos, and argued to him that, this was the equivalent of Google or Apple before they became icons of Silicon Valley, and that his story should focus on that, and that's what his story ended up focusing on. He went out and met with Elizabeth and interviewed her over 7 hours in several increments. And that cover story in June 2014, she had already been put on the map by my own newspaper, our editorial page, and then Wired had written about her as well. But that Fortune magazine story is really what rocketed her to fame and made her a celebrity.
Yeah, I mean, she was one of the most influential people in 2015 from Time. Like, she hung out with the Clintons like that. I mean, there was a politics angle, too, right? I mean, especially in, I guess that was 2015 or 2016, when she was friends with Chelsea Clinton and throwing fundraisers for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. What role did politics have in this?
Well, she definitely cultivated politicians. She cultivated Jim Mattis, who is now our Secretary of Defense, after he retired from the military. A couple months later, he joined the Theranos board. Her main point of entry with the political class was George Shultz, the former Secretary of State who crafted the Reagan administration's foreign policy. George lives right off the Stanford campus, has always been passionate about science. Elizabeth was introduced to him in early 2011, and he quickly joined the board. And then he introduced her to Henry Kissinger and Bill Frist, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, former Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. And that's how she came to have this unbelievable board made up of these former cabinet members and ex-military commanders. And she also cultivated, as you said, the Clintons. She did several events with the Clinton Foundation, was interviewed on stage by Bill Clinton, and became friendly with Chelsea. And that fundraiser you refer to, which was initially going to be held at the headquarters of Theranos and then was relocated, that actually happened a good 5 months after I broke the scandal. And it was becoming increasingly clear from the fallout and from regulators' actions that my reporting was correct. And yet she still managed to be invited to this Clinton fundraiser at the house of an entrepreneur in San Francisco and even addressed the audience there. And there's a picture of her that you can easily find on the web standing next to Chelsea Clinton holding a microphone.
So you said it was 6 months after your report came out in 2015 and at the point at which it was believed. So in the beginning, Theranos attacked you, said what you written wasn't true, that you were in bed with the people that, you know, that she was trying to disrupt, in bed with the current medical industry, just sort of painted their own picture of your what was behind your reporting. Talk a little bit about what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, the aggressive counterattack started even before publication, way before publication. In June of 2015, David Boies, who was at that time outside counsel for Theranos, came with several of his associates, and Heather King, who had been a partner at Boies Schiller, had also once been a Hillary Clinton aide, and she had just become general counsel of Theranos, so she was like an arm of Boies Schiller at Theranos. The four of them and three other people came to our offices, and we had this conflictual and very surreal 5-hour meeting in a conference room in the Midtown Manhattan newsroom of the Journal. And their demeanors were very aggressive. You know, they put little tape recorders at the beginning of the meeting at each end of the conference room table, and the message was unmistakably that they were considering the meeting as a sort of deposition in a future legal proceeding. I pulled out my iPhone and started pressing record as well. I figured if they're recording, I need to record too. And then they told us that that I had misappropriated Theranos trade secrets and that I needed to destroy them or return them as soon as possible. And they refused to answer many of my questions about how many blood tests were done on Theranos technology and how many on commercial machines, claiming that these were trade secrets. And so we went around in circles for like hours. You know, it got tense at times. David Boies at times got angry, told us at one point during the meeting that he was going to send us a letter making clear what Theranos' legal stance was. And sure enough, a couple of days later, we got the letter. And then more letters after that that, you know, very explicitly threatened us with litigation, with a lawsuit if we pursued the reporting any further. And then it got even more surreal when I became convinced, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that some of my confidential sources were being surveilled. One of my sources was Tyler Schultz, the grandson of George Schultz, who's on the board of Theranos. And Tyler had worked for 8 months at the company, and I had made contact with him, and he had corroborated what many of the things that my first source had told me. Suddenly, he went dark, and I figured I couldn't reach him anymore, even though I had the number of this burner phone that he'd been contacting me with. And I also had this email address. He was no longer returning calls or emails. And I figured Theranos was putting the screws to him. I didn't learn until a year later what had happened. Theranos ambushed him at his grandfather's house one evening in the spring of 2015. And one of the Boies Schiller attorneys, Mike Brill, was like an attack dog and tried to force him to admit that he was talking to a journal reporter, and tried to get him to sign documents and to name the journal sources. And Tyler, that was the starting point of a pressure campaign that lasted months. And Theranos tried to essentially get Tyler to recant what he had told me and to also name my sources. And Tyler had to get legal representation, which ended up costing his parents nearly $500,000. And he put up with an unbelievable ordeal for months until we finally published my story in October of 2015. And then, as you said, the pushback continued. David Boies gave several interviews in which he hinted that Theranos would sue. Heather King, the general counsel, after each story that I published, sent the journal letters insisting that we print retractions for essentially everything that I had written in my stories, and putting us on notice that if we didn't, we would get sued. So it was tense, but at the same time, I had done so much reporting, I had talked to so many people that I knew I was in the right. And Elizabeth Holmes came to our tech conference in Laguna Beach about 10 days after my story was published, and I figured she was going to come out swinging, but what I didn't expect is her to lie again and again, bald-faced lie, the way she did over the course of this half-hour interview with our technology editor. And that was pretty stunning. But when I thought about it, it was also in character and really dovetailed with everything I had heard about the way she operated. So this, you know, this sort of counterattack lasted for months, until finally one of the health regulators, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, made public the findings of its regulatory inspection. And it became clear that according to Theranos' own data, its Edison machine, which, by the way, was only used for at most 12 tests, didn't work. Its results were all over the map and completely unreliable. And then the inspection report also showed that there were innumerable problems with the way the lab was run, that the lab didn't have a real director, that most of the tests were run on commercial machines, and pretty much, you know, confirmed all of my reporting. And she was July 2016 banned by CMS from running a laboratory for 2 years. And by then, the Securities and Exchange Commission and the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco had both opened investigations. And as we now know, the SEC a couple months ago filed fraud charges against Elizabeth and Sonny and Theranos. Elizabeth settled them without admitting or denying wrongdoing. Sonny is fighting them. And the criminal investigation is ongoing.
Wow. So we have a chat room that watches live with us right now. And Knox Harrington in the chat room says this would make a great movie. And it is. Someone has already bought the rights to the movie. He also asks, I'm trying to think who should play Holmes. And someone guessed Jessica Chastain or Jennifer Lawrence, which it is going to be Jennifer Lawrence, obviously. I'm very excited about that. And someone else in the chat room said that Elizabeth Holmes has had the secret to being successful: be young, pretty, and know how to never blink. And so I want to take a break to thank our sponsor. But after that, I want to talk about that and gender, because it played a really interesting role in this whole story. Because we do. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking about gender inequality in technology, and this isn't exactly that, but it is complicated. And I want to talk to you about that as well. But first, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. The mortgage process was not keeping up with the times. You know, it was old-fashioned, dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's what I love about so many of our sponsors. There's a problem, and you throw technology at it, and you solve it. They will give you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It is super simple. You can fully understand all the details and then be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. A mortgage is a very, very personal thing. You want the one that you can afford for the house that you want. And Rocket Mortgage is also very convenient. They have trusted partners that allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button on your smartphone, on your tablet, Android, iOS. It's everywhere you are, and it's powerful. So you might be looking to buy your first home. Maybe you're lucky enough to be buying your 10th home. If you have 10 homes, please tell me how you did that. I would like to know. Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. So you and your one home or your 10, you can find the right mortgage for any of your homes. So this is all based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage will analyze all of your home loan options, all of the ones that you qualify for, and then find the one that's right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Don't forget to add the triangulation. That is how Rocket Mortgage knew that you came from us to them. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for sponsoring Triangulation. I am talking to John Carreyrou. He is a Wall Street Journal reporter and the author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, which is about Theranos. And I all throughout reading your book and you know, reading your stories first in the journal and thinking about this story, I just think that gender has played such an interesting role, because and youth also, age. Elizabeth Holmes was 19 when she started. She was very attractive, had giant blue eyes. And you know, we don't spend a lot of time talking about what color eyes Mark Zuckerberg has or what color he dyed his hair. But I think that a lot of this happened because she was a woman. And I think people were hungry for a female Steve Jobs or a female Mark Zuckerberg. Or just someone that, you know, they could say, look, like, we, you know, everyone can do this. But unfortunately, she was a liar and a fraud. So I don't know what that says about this. But let's talk a little bit about, like, the people that were on her side, Tim Draper and then the CEO of Safeway. And what role do you think gender played in their just sort of overlooking the obvious problems with what she was doing?
I think gender did play a role in her rise, and you know, she really charmed older men. It may be controversial to say that these days amid the Me Too movement, but if you look at the 12-year history of Theranos before I came along and exposed what was going on, it was one older man after another that she wrapped around her finger, and whose support she gained. It started with Channing Robinson, her Stanford Engineering School professor, who joined her board when she founded the company as a Stanford dropout, and accompanied her to pitch meetings with VCs, gave her credibility when she was just a teenager. She later met Don Lucas, and Don Lucas was you know, enamored with her. I think he saw her almost as a daughter. And later George Shultz and all these other older men, General Mattis, Rupert Murdoch, eventually David Boies. It's clear that she, I think, used her gender, you know, to her advantage with these older men. And I don't think it was necessarily sexual at all. I think they were just they were taken in by her intelligence, by her charisma, by her charm. And she was incredibly persuasive about this vision that she had, and they wanted to support her. The other way in which gender played a role is that there was this yearning in Silicon Valley for a tech founder who would make it as big as the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Steve Jobs and the Larry Pages and Sergey Brins. In other words, the first tech founder billionaire who was a woman. And there have been other prominent women in Silicon Valley who also become very wealthy, like Marissa Mayer and Sheryl Sandberg, number two at Facebook. But they were not founders. They didn't found their own companies. They were the hired help. They were early employees at Google. And so Elizabeth would have been that first female billionaire founder. And there was an appetite for that, and she fulfilled that appetite, and unfortunately it was not real.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say, like, we use whatever we've got, right? I mean, like, just trying, you know, you trying to convince someone of your products, the importance of your product, you kind of just, you do what you need to do, whoever you are. But you don't have to, like, the fact is, like, she was misrepresenting a medical product, not just saying, like, I have this device that's going to, you know, juice all your organic vegetables for you. She was saying something that, you know, she was talking about people telling people whether they had cancer or not. So, I mean, there's an extent at which, you know, it has nothing to do with the fact that she was a woman. She was a liar.
Right. I mean, you know, when it's fraud, it's fraud. It doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman. The gender becomes irrelevant. If there really is fraud going on, there's white collar crime going on, then you know, in some ways, I would argue that it's a sign of equality. We now have, you know, a woman has joined the ranks of con men. And that's a sign that, you know, as there are more women in business who become high profile, that as is the case with men, some of them will be bad apples. Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. I mean, it's not okay that frauds are committed, but I think I should accept that women too can be villains. You know, it's not always men.
So was there, as I was reading this, I kept thinking, were there a lot of Theranoses? Like, were there a lot of people pitching products like this, but that companies just, investors did their due diligence? And, you know, is the Valley full of companies like that? People trying to push even medical devices that aren't exactly working, but they happen to have founders that didn't, that people weren't so hungry to give money to?
I don't think so in the medical space. I think that the fake it till you make it is definitely has long been part of Silicon Valley's DNA. There's a term that was coined in the early 80s called vaporware, and it's used to describe computer software or hardware that was announced with great fanfare by a company and then either never delivered or delivered years late without the promised features. And, you know, people like Steve Jobs and Larry Ellison were accused at various points of engaging in this practice. I think it's more acceptable, that sort of behavior is more acceptable when you're dealing with a computer product or a smartphone app that isn't a product that's going to be used to make health decisions. I think the second you enter the medical realm, you have to be reminded of the fact that your end user ultimately is the patient and that your product is going to have an impact on that patient's life. And that's something, unfortunately, that Elizabeth Holmes either lost sight of or chose to deliberately ignore. And I think that's one of the huge lessons of the Theranos scandal, as the traditional tech industry in Silicon Valley and health innovation increasingly converge. I think that convergence is only going to intensify, I would say, to the founders and the VCs active in this health tech space. You know, remember always that ultimately you're dealing with patients, and Theranos is exhibit A of what can go wrong if you don't bear that in mind.
So do you feel like you got pushback about your writing starting in 2015 because she was a woman? Like, did you get a feeling of did you get attacked for being sexist, for attacking this woman that they wanted to be the first, you know, young female billionaire founder?
There was some of that. I mean, most of it was driven by Elizabeth herself. She, you know, spun this narrative that I was sexist. And, you know, she gave an interview to Bloomberg Businessweek, which did a cover story. I think it was in November of 2000, or might have been December of 2015, about a month after I came out with my first story. And And, you know, Elizabeth is very explicit in that story, saying that the difficulties that she's encountering are due to her gender, and that, basically playing the sexist card. There were other venture capitalists, I think, in Silicon Valley who also argued that point. The people who said this, I think, stopped saying it as the months went by and as regulatory inspections and investigations one by one bore out my reporting. And I think, 99.9% of people now realize that the Wall Street Journal was right all along and that this was a fraud. I think the only person who doesn't recognize it, or at least says that he doesn't, is Tim Draper. And Draper's position seems to be that because Elizabeth had a cool vision and was a bold entrepreneur, that excuses everything. Sort of the ends justifies the means. And I think most people would disagree with that. If you have a cool vision, it doesn't mean that you can break the law and that you can commit white collar crime, which is what happened in this case. Startup founders have to abide by the laws like everyone else. And just because you're an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, it doesn't mean that you're exempt.
So what is Elizabeth Holmes doing now, and why is she not in jail?
Well, as we talked about earlier, the SEC has charged her with fraud, and she has settled that. She has paid $500,000 penalty. She has relinquished most of her stock, relinquished her voting control of the company, agreed to an officer director ban from a public company. She won't be able to be an officer or director in a public company for the next 10 years. There are many people who think that this SEC settlement was a slap on the wrist and wasn't commensurate with the magnitude of the wrongdoing here. What people may forget is that there is this second investigation that's now been going on for 2.5 years, spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And that investigation is very advanced. I think we should know in a matter of months what its outcome is. I hear from sources that criminal indictments of Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani are a distinct possibility. People forget that sometimes, these cases are challenging to put together. They take time. It took years for the Enron executives to be brought to justice and to be put behind bars. This is a complex case that involves healthcare and labs. But I am pretty confident that in the end, federal prosecutors will take action, and then there should be a trial, and we'll see what happens from there.
I know you talk to a lot of Elizabeth Holmes's lawyers, but am I right that you've never actually spoke with her?
That's right. I tried to interview her for 5.5 months before my first story in October 2015 was published. And then sporadically, I went back to her PR people and asked for interviews and was always turned down. I made another big push when I went on book leave in the fall of 2016. And I argued to her PR handler that, this was Elizabeth's chance to influence the narrative in the book and to give her input. And it really, she had nothing to lose from doing that. But I didn't get anywhere with that argument. And she has steadfastly refused to speak to me.
So do you think, you write so much about how Theranos went, did sort of an end run, tried to do an end run around the FDA. But is there a way in which the FDA is a little bit stifling innovation in some ways? I'm glad that Theranos didn't get through all these trials. But is there a way in which you think innovation might be stifled a little bit by the policies, the current policies of the FDA?
I don't see how. If anything, the Theranos story argues for more power to be given to the FDA. And the FDA, in fact, in recent years, in the final years of the Obama administration, was working on trying to close this loophole that Theranos exploited, which has to do with laboratory developed tests, which are tests that labs fashion with their own methods and their own devices, as opposed to blood tests that are run on FDA approved diagnostic equipment. And historically, the FDA has not policed that area of the lab business, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the chief regulator of labs, has also not closely policed laboratory developed tests. And Theranos really ran an 18-wheeler truck through that loophole by arguing that its finger stick tests were laboratory developed tests because they were done on proprietary Theranos technology that was not commercialized and not sold to other labs. And that enabled it to keep both of those regulators at arm's length. And so I would argue that the Theranos scandal, would beg for more regulation of the lab space and to give the FDA more power. But unfortunately, under the Trump administration, the FDA has gone in the opposite direction and has abandoned its push to police LDTs, which I think is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. So when you see like Apple, the Apple Watch getting in, you know, now like I'll be notified if my heart rate is elevated when I'm just, you know, sitting down, and there's like they're slowly moving more into that health space, and Cardia is, you know, another health device that I think has FDA approval that was, you know, made by someone who used to work at Google. Like, so when you see those tech titans moving into the health space, does that worry you?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't think that everyone in Silicon Valley is corrupt. I think that there are a lot of people, who have moral compasses and have boundaries and know what bright red lines not to cross. Apple is a very mature company now. It's been around for decades. It's got the money to hire people who can help it get it right. Including regulatory compliance people and scientists and doctors. And there's no reason that they can't put as many resources in that as they put in building smartwatches and smartphones.
So you mentioned that still no one has cracked the code of having to get, like, you know, all these tests with just a single pin prick of blood. Are there currently people working in this space?
There have been many researchers in academia and industry that have been working on that, I'd argue, for the past 15, 20 years. And no one has gotten close to, basically solving the problem that you have to use completely different instruments and techniques for these different classes of blood tests. Another problem is, even though you have had progress in microfluidics, there's always some loss of blood when you transfer the small sample to the microfluidic device, and a loss of a teeny bit of sample doesn't matter when you've got quite a bit of sample, but when you're already starting from a small quantity, losing some in that transfer is usually a big setback and hard to recover from. So I'm not necessarily pessimistic that some of these challenges won't be solved in the coming decade and decades, but it's going to take time and it's going to take a lot of research. And, it's not easy. Medical research and science are not easy.
So I know we didn't talk much about Sonny Balwani, who was Elizabeth's boyfriend. And so I'll leave that to the book. People, you have to read the book to find out how he features in this bizarre story. So the book's going to be made into a movie. Do you know who's writing the script?
Vanessa Taylor, who co-wrote The Shape of Water. Has recently been hired to write the screenplay, and I've already talked to her several times. And I think she's great. And, Adam McKay is slated to direct. So that's Jennifer Lawrence to play Elizabeth Holmes. It's kind of a dream team, really, that's come together for this movie.
I can't wait. I hope that she gets that deep voice right, the affected deep voice. It's so I still watch videos of Elizabeth Holmes because I just... It's just, I mean, I know it's not politically correct to talk about women's voices, and women get get criticized constantly for having high uplift, and I'm a podcaster, I've heard it all, but it is really bizarre. So I hope she's able to, I'm sure she will be able to capture that that part of Elizabeth Holmes, I guess, obsession with Steve Jobs. So now are you done reporting this story? I mean, the story is not over. So is this still your most important beat, or have you moved on?
I'm beginning to move on. I mean, I'm going to keep an eye on developments with Theranos, and there are two shoes that I expect to drop, and that I'm waiting to see whether they drop. One is the company being liquidated by Fortress Investment Group, which is the private equity firm that loaned it $65 million last year to keep it afloat. That liquidation of the Theranos assets by Fortress should happen by August, at which point the company should cease to exist. I'll probably write a story about that. And then the other big shoe that I'm watching for is what happens with the criminal investigation. And then it's fair to say that I'll be moving on to other stories, but I'll be updating the epilogue of the book for the paperback edition when it comes out in a year with whatever has happened between now and then.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. John Carreyrou is the author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It is available anywhere you get books. The audiobook also available. If you start reading the Kindle, just start reading the Kindle sample, and you will not be able to not finish it. That was how I started. And it's just like when you get to the end of that sample, because I hate reading in the Kindle. I need books, but I always try that first. So I promise if you start reading it, you won't want to stop. So thank you so much. And you can follow John at the Wall Street Journal or at John Carreyrou on Twitter. And thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
All right. Take care. And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records every Friday around 3 p.m. Pacific, or whenever we can track down our guests. And you can watch live at twit.tv/live. And, of course, you can get it, the video or the audio podcast, wherever fine podcasts are given away free. You can download them and subscribe to Triangulation. And every week you'll get a new and interesting long-form interview with someone who is exploring all of the interesting things going on in tech. And you can subscribe at twit.tv/try, T-R-I. Thanks so much for coming on.